is Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's Media Roundtable, where we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. Today, we begin by discussing El Salvador. Last month, El Salvador's parliament approved a state of emergency that temporarily restricts civil liberties and freedom of the press following a recent wave of deadly gang violence there. According to the investigative site El Faro, March 26th was, in fact, the most violent day of the last 20 years in El Salvador. Authorities registered 62 murders in just 24 hours, far more than the average 3.4 murders per day throughout 2020 and 2021. And so, citing this violence, El Salvador's parliament immediately enacted a 30-day state of exception that suspends the right to association and legal defense, increases the period of detention without cause from 72 hours to 15 days, and allows the government to intercept communications without a warrant. Last Sunday, the parliament then extended the measure for one extra month. So to get the latest on the government's response to gang violence in El Salvador, we're so pleased to be joined by Anna Catherine Brigida, a freelance journalist and an editor for El Faro English, Central America's leading investigative journalism outlet. She's covered migration, politics, security, human rights, environmental justice, and more in Mexico and Central America since 2015. So, Anna, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me and for covering this important issue.
Absolutely. Well, the crisis in El Salvador is finally beginning to get more attention because of both the rise in deadly gang violence and the extreme response by the country's president, Nayib Bukele. And according to the New York Times, 18,000 people have been arrested there after a spike in killings in March that I referenced led the government to declare the state of emergency and suspend key civil liberties guaranteed in the Constitution there. So I wanted to begin by asking you, what explains this widespread crackdown?
Yeah, so you began to mention the context of it. It began with the country's most violent day in 20 years. So really during Nayib Bukele's administration, homicides have been dropping. But there's important context there, which sort of sets this all up, which is that El Faro has reported that Bukele's administration had negotiated with gangs for a drop in homicides. And what many security experts were saying for a long time was that one of the major issues with this, with these negotiations, is that it meant that this decrease in homicides was not going to be sustainable. And at some point, there was going to be this increase in this spike in homicides, and that was what was seen at the end of March. And so then that led to the state of exception. So then, you know, Bukele had to do something to respond to that spike in homicides and to show that he's tough on crime, which has always been a popular response in El Salvador, called mano dura policies. So cracking down on gangs and violence, you know, through mass detentions, through sending more military and police to the streets, that has always been popular in El Salvador, although it has not been effective. Mm-hmm. So that is what brings us to what's happening today, through the past month or so in El Salvador. We've seen the most detentions. It's now more than 20,000 because it's increasing every day. So this is sort of the most extreme response of any government.
Yeah. Well, so who is being swept up in these raids? Do we know yet?
Well, according to the government, they're all gang members and terrorists. According to human rights groups and to family members, many of the people being swept up are not people who are involved in any gang activity, people who do not have any criminal record, many young people, you know, just who live in gang-controlled neighborhoods. The police union has come out and stated that they are being pressured to carry out a certain amount of arrests per day. And so within with all of that information, you know, it casts a lot of doubt on the government narrative that all of these people are actually gang members. The government has said that they plan to continue until they capture all the gang members, which is estimated to be about 70,000 people. So still more to go.
Yeah. Well, and you've written that some of these people have just disappeared. There's really no record of them. So do you have a sense as to how many are essentially have dropped out of the system, out of visibility, versus those that at least we would know where they're at within the system?
Well, it's very difficult to determine. I mean, when you just think about the sheer number of it, I mean, 20,000 people is just a incredibly large number. And this is a very small country, 6.5 million people, more or less, in the entire country. So it's just an incredibly large number. And that is one of the issues that many human rights groups are pointing out, is that it's just overwhelming the system. It's just too many people to keep track of, for judges to, too many cases for judges to be able to handle, too many cases for public prosecutors to be able to handle. So it's just, it's hard to say exactly how many. Some people are being released after public pressure, social media campaigns. So I do not believe that the 20,000 people arrested are currently in prison, but it's hard to say an exact number of how many people are lost in the system.
Yeah. But then at the same time, and you've noted this too, that there seems to be a fair amount of public support in El Salvador for these measures. But given the number of people that have been swept up in this, I'm surprised that there is such support. So can you describe a bit about the dynamics there, why people, you know, generally might be in favor of these kinds of measures, despite the large numbers of people that have been caught up in this?
Yeah, well, number one, Bukele has been a very popular president. He has filled a gap in El Salvador. The two traditional parties, when he came to office in 2019, people were very fed up with the two traditional parties and felt that they had not resolved the issues that they faced on a day-to-day basis, one of which is gang violence. So just in general, Bukele has been a very popular president, although some of his policies have become less popular. For example, the Bitcoin law is one of his less popular policies. So I would say that there are some cracks in that popularity. So
to interrupt you there, just you mentioned the Bitcoin law. Can you explain what that was?
Sorry, yes. Opening up a Pandora's box there. But yes, El Salvador became the first country to make Bitcoin a legal tender in June of last year. And that's one of Bukele's most unpopular policies. Mm-hmm. So just mention that to give an example of one of the things that he's done that has decreased his popularity, but he still remains a very popular president. So that's one aspect of it. And then the other aspect is just in general, you know, gang violence is a huge issue that cannot be denied. Many people, you know, want to feel safer in their communities, and they want a quick solution. They want someone to resolve that issue, and Bukele has promised to solve that issue. So traditionally, these types of strong hand policies have been very popular in El Salvador. Just because they're popular doesn't necessarily mean that they are effective. But there are many people who trust him and want him to resolve this problem. There are some people who obviously are being affected by this, and their family members are being affected. So that could be changing their public perception of him. But I think it's too early to tell exactly how the state of exception is going to shift public opinion of Bukele.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the root causes of this gang violence. So you mentioned that this has been a sort of long suffering feature of life in El Salvador. What are the causes of this gang violence that we now see this crackdown reaction to?
Yeah, well, it dates decades back, and the gangs actually, you know, started in Los Angeles. MS-13 and 18th Street are actually two gangs that started in LA and were mostly sent to El Salvador through gang deportations. And then in the mostly the 1980s, 1990s, and then grew because of just the sort of lack of preparation at that point for the government to be receiving these deportees. El Salvador was coming out of civil war, 12-year civil war in 1992. And really, obviously very complex issue, but the gangs are really, many youth don't have opportunities in El Salvador, and that is an issue that the gangs sort of fill in this gap, and that allows the gangs to have a bigger presence, and the lack of the impunity in El Salvador as well allows the gangs to continue to flourish, and so it's just been a problem that has not been able past governments have not been able to get it under control. There's been different attempts to, for example, negotiate with the gangs, mm-hmm. To potentially get the problem under control. But that has actually, most experts say, turned the gangs into more of political actors and given them more power. So it's a very complex issue in El Salvador, mm-hmm. and it has no simple solution. So yeah. I think anytime a government is saying that they are going to offer a simple solution, anyone should be skeptical. Mm-hmm.
Well, and the government there has been taking credit for a reduction in gang violence, but your news organization, El Faro, revealed in September 2020 that Bukele's government, in fact, had been negotiating with the MS-13 gang for a reduction in homicides, and I think you referenced this earlier. Can you talk a bit about that deal that they struck? Is it problematic? How so? And you also mentioned that it critics were saying it was always going to be unsustainable. So why would that be the case with this deal? I'd love to get more insight on what went down between the government there and the negotiations with the gangs.
Yeah, I think a few key points there. Number one was that it was a negotiation for a decrease in homicides, and that there were also a negotiation for political favors. So that is a key problem with gang negotiations. Another issue is that it's been the lack of transparency with gang negotiations. There are actually some experts who say that there is the potential to negotiate with gangs to end this problem, but it would have to be in a totally different way. That's more transparent, that does not involve exchanging political favors, and that would actually involve a reintegration and disarming of gang members so that it actually ends the gangs. And the way that the government carried out the negotiations, as reported by El Faro, did not meet that criteria. And the government has never recognized this reporting and continues to deny it. So that is part of the reason why it's so problematic, because it leads to these backdoor negotiations that then can fall apart. It's unclear what the government is offering in exchange for this decrease in homicides. And then it can end up in this spike in violence, as we saw in March.
Well, so would transparency have sort of remedied this situation? I mean, what would have been a better alternative to try to address the gang problem in El Salvador from your perspective?
Well, it is very complex, because the transparency issue cannot be resolved very easily, because gangs are considered terrorist groups and gang negotiations are criminalized. So that that requires a sort of complex solution where the gangs would have to not be considered terrorist groups. Also, the State Department considers them terrorist groups. So that is a very complex issue, and that is a very long-term solution that can't really be resolved overnight. Definitely, I think everybody or all of the human rights groups agree that violating due process and mass human rights violations and more militarization, that has never been the answer. Usually, mm-hmm. More social programs, more investment in education, more investment in public programs, things like that, more addressing the social issues in El Salvador that mm-hmm. lead gangs to flourish is more of of a long-term solution.
Those underlying causes. Yeah. So if you're just joining us, this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and we're so pleased to be joined by Anna Catherine Brigida, freelance journalist and editor for El Faro English. We're discussing the situation in El Salvador and the government's recent crackdown on the rise in gang violence there. If you'd like to call and ask any questions about El Salvador, if you're from El Salvador, have relatives there, and have thoughts about what the state of life is like down there, you can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. So, Anna, let me ask you about exactly the situation there in El Salvador in terms of civil liberties and press freedom, especially for you as a journalist. How has it been trying to get information out of El Salvador? What are you hearing just in terms of what life is like for civil liberties and basic press freedom?
I would say as a journalist, I've definitely noticed a change in terms of how difficult it's become to report. I would say that sources are very scared to talk. People that I've known now for years and who have been my sources for a long time recently, you know, don't want to speak on the record. They're not just worried about meeting in person. They're worried about speaking on the phone because there's been reports that the government, that many journalists and human rights groups have what's called Pegasus on their phone, which is a form of spyware that only governments are able to access. So there's reports of the government using spyware to look at communications. And that's also part of the state of exception that makes it easier for them to do that. And so there's definitely a culture of fear in El Salvador. There's also been a lot of harassment towards journalists. Bukele and members of his party often will take to Twitter to call out journalists and harass them. And then that leads to also their supporters harassing them. Women in particular will get a lot of rape threats and things like that. So it is very serious. And it definitely has shifted from when I first started there. And it's become just a lot more difficult to share information, which is what we're trying to do as journalists.
Mm-hmm. And are journalists also targeted by the gangs down there?
You know, I would say that really the big issue for journalists right now in terms of press freedom is the government, more than gangs. I mean, obviously you have to be careful, with all types of sources, but, right now I think the main issue among, my colleagues is more state surveillance and state harassment.
Mm-hmm. And I have to ask, is there a sense out there that some of this crackdown is an effort by President Bukele to consolidate power? I mean, typically with autocrats, you know, you'll see a crackdown on a rise in crime used as a bit of an excuse to really take over democratic institutions. Is that part of the equation here, or at least part of the skepticism among critics of Bukele's moves here?
Yeah, that is definitely something that has been brought up by different human rights groups. Usually the institution that these human rights groups would turn to would be the Constitutional Court. On May 1st of last year, when Bukele's party took a supermajority in the Legislative Assembly, one of the first moves that they made was to remove the Constitutional Court members and to replace them with people who are loyal to their party. And so that institution, the Constitutional Court, many organizations don't consider it to be an independent institution anymore. And so whenever things like this happen in El Salvador, there's a feeling now that there's not really anywhere to turn to, that the institutions and the checks and balances that used to be in place have been eroded. And definitely the extension of the state of exception is something that's worrying, because it's unclear if, you know, is it just going to be one more month? Is it going to continue another month? You know, 30 days, now 60 days, how long is it going to be?
Yeah, a lot of uncertainty there. Yeah. Well, let's go to the phone lines. We have a caller, Steve, dialing in. So, Steve, welcome to Your Calls Media Roundtable.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's your question for our guest today?
Yes. Actually, you know, I understand that the country has a problem with youth and gangs, and that's because obviously they don't have an opportunity for a job. And I was wondering if maybe the journalist could focus in on all the corruption and kickbacks within government that's preventing companies from going down there and opening up factories or, you know, investments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you, Steve. That's a great question. Anna Catherine, Brigida, what are your thoughts on corruption as part of the underlying causes here that's really dampening economic investment?
Yeah, that's a great point. I'm glad that Steve brought that up because that's something that we hadn't gotten a chance to talk about. But corruption is definitely part of the bigger picture of violence and migration and everything that's happening in El Salvador. Bukele actually campaigned on an anti-corruption platform. But unfortunately, you know, the evidence that has been revealed by El Faro and many other outlets is that his government has been involved in many different corruption scandals. And so that is a hindrance. I mean, it's something that, for example, the U.S. government, it's a priority for U.S. government in terms of cutting back on corruption. But I think it ties into what we were speaking about in terms of the institutions. That's why it's so worrying with the lack of checks and balances, because when there's no checks and balances, you know, then that allows corruption to flourish. So I think it is all part of a bigger picture. And it's one of the reasons why the state of exception is so worrying to many human rights groups and groups that are working in terms of democracy, because they see that as also contributing to a culture that can lead to corruption. And as Steve pointed out, then that also can contribute to the lack of economic opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you, Steve, in San Francisco, for that question. And I want to ask you about the role of the United States in all of this. And obviously, the U.S. has a pretty direct interest, because I know a lot of this gang violence has prompted a lot of the migration out of the country, and a lot of the crises that we've been experiencing at our border is because of the violence in Central America. So what's been the role of the U.S. To date here?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, the U.S. has been much more focused on anti-corruption efforts and trying to promote strong democratic institutions in El Salvador and in Central America recently. Of course, there's always a lot of skepticism with any U.S. efforts because of the history in the region of you know, supporting coups, for example, like in Guatemala in the past, in 1954, things like that, supporting past military governments. So there's always skepticism when the U.S. is getting involved, but at least the rhetoric and of this government, of the Biden administration, has been to support strengthening of democratic institutions. Unfortunately, Bukele has not been very responsive to international pressure. So I would say the efforts have been not very successful so far, and that's been a challenge. But that is the effort that the U.S. is trying to make right now.
Mm-hmm. And wasn't this one of the priorities for Vice President Harris, to really focus on the root causes of migration? I mean, is there a need for more U.S. Aid to El Salvador? What would be the sort of optimal role the U.S. could play down there?
I think in terms of talking about U.S. aid, I think the question should always be not necessarily whether it should be more or less, but what it should be focused on. And it should always be, I think, led by the local organizations and what they say and what they say that they need and the initiatives that they need support for. So I think, for example, you know, in the past, the U.S. has given a lot of aid to the police and military in Central America, and that's something that's been criticized and is starting to shift. And many groups on the ground in Central America say that that's not the aid that they need. So I think the question is always, what's the aid going to, rather than if it's more or less.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's such a important story, and I'm so glad that you've been covering it. It just gets overlooked too often, what happens down with our neighbors to the south, and it's really critical that we pay attention to countries like El Salvador. So I just want to thank you, Anna Catherine Brigida, a freelance journalist and editor for El Faro English, Central America's leading investigative journalism outlet. Thank you for joining us on Your Call and for all your great work covering this important issue.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. And we'll be back after this to talk about the oil and gas industry's influence in California state politics. This is Ethan Elkind, Your Call's Media Roundtable. We'll be back right after this.